My name is Mike Seelig, and this is Voices from Our Community. There's a reason why many of us are trying to reduce the use of our cars. It's not the wear and tear as much as it is the burning of the fuel. We know that petroleum products are bad for our health, and it's very bad for our planet. But the bottom line is, the price of gas is just too high. I wanted to learn more about what the true cost of a gallon of gas was, so I contacted the Sightline Institute in Seattle. Sightline is an independent nonprofit research and communication center. Their mission is to make the Northwest a global model of sustainability with strong communities, a green economy, and a healthy environment. Eric DePlace with Sightline agreed to talk to me over a Zoom connection. Something I noticed about the audio quality of the connection was every once in a while, Eric and I sounded like we were turning into cyborg robots. I assure you that neither of us did. It's safe to say, in your opinion, the full cost of gas is not covered with what we pay at the pump. Could you tell me what you think we're overlooking when we think about the cost of gas?
Yeah, it's a great question. And on a superficial level, yes, it is absolutely true that the full cost of gas is not reflected in the price that you pay at the pump. Maybe it's, you know, $3, I think it is right about now. And that is, you know, really just the tip of the iceberg of the true cost of what it takes to extract the underlying crude oil, transport it, refine it, move it into our vehicles, burn it. And I'm happy to kind of walk through each of those components, but really it's a story of the life cycle. It's the story of what happens when you have we typically interact with gasoline really just at one point. We walk up to a gas pump and we take the little thing off the, and we stick the handle in the car and there you go. A few minutes later, you're on your way. But that story starts in a geological formation somewhere and it ends in the atmosphere. And so by understanding that whole kind of chain of events, we get some clear picture of what the true cost is, and maybe it'd be worth me kind of walking through at least a few kind of components of that.
That'd be great. Today.
Okay. So if you're in the Northwest and you put, let's say you put 10 gallons of gasoline into your vehicle, in very rough terms, think about maybe 3 of those gallons come from the North Slope of Alaska. 3 of those gallons come from the tar sands of Alberta, and 3 of those gallons come from the fracking fields in North Dakota. And there's another gallon in there that's from somewhere else. In the Pacific Northwest, the vast majority of our crude oil, which is the underlying product that we refine into gasoline, it's sourced in one of those 3 locations. And each one of those locations has its own particular profile of risk and extraction. It has its own corporate profile, its own way of being. All of them are very harmful, but they're harmful in different ways. And I won't, at this moment, elaborate on all of the differences between each of them. But I will say, drilling oil on the fringes of the Arctic Ocean in northern Alaska, moving that by pipeline to Valdez, and then shipping it south, which is how we traditionally, that was the majority of our oil that's refined in Washington and then sold to consumers throughout the region. That carries with it a tremendous risk profile, both for the Arctic and, as we saw, have seen a couple of times in terms of oil spills that can be extremely damaging economically as well as ecologically. Happy to dig into some of the implications from the really serious damages of oil spills. The Bakken Formation in North Dakota is our newest contributor. Alaska has kind of waned in importance, and starting around 2012, we really started to see the rise of the Bakken. Folks in Vancouver, Washington, may be more familiar with most than that, because that's the source of the oil trains. That's where almost all of our oil trains come from, and the big oil by rail proposal in Vancouver would have been sourced almost entirely from the Bakken. Those are deep underground shale formations. It's oil that's trapped between layers of sedimentary rock and is used, and by using fracking technology, they can go way down, crack those rocks open with explosives and extract that oil. It's very light, very volatile, and as we've seen, very prone to exploding in the wrong circumstances, including in Mosier, Oregon, lots of other places too. Fracking has a whole litany of things that are problematic about it. Obviously, trains that explode, not a great situation. And then the third location is the Alberta tar sands, and that's probably of the 3 the most destructive of all. From a geological perspective, almost the exact opposite of the Bakken. It is a mix of hydrocarbons, clay, and sand. It's mined. It's actually sort of dug out of the earth, and it's about the consistency of peanut butter if you rolled it around the beach for a while. It's really nasty, gross stuff. It has to be treated very energy intensively and chemically in order to turn it into something that we can even refine then further into gasoline. That stuff is mostly shipped by pipeline to the west, in a pipeline that's slated for tripling in capacity. The tar sands is an environmental disaster by any metric. The point of extraction all the way right up until you burn it in your gas tank. It's a real mess, which isn't to say the others are good, just that one's really bad, extra bad. And so I think, you know, if you sort of start from that perspective and locate your 10 gallons of gasoline in those regions, it gives us some sense that your impact when you put that stuff in your car, and I've got a car, I drive my car, but, you know, I am touching northern Alaska, the Arctic Ocean, I'm touching the frack fields in North Dakota, I'm touching the tar sands in Alberta. And that's, I think, a starting point for figuring out what the real cost is.
How the gas we use is extracted and how it's transported was just the starting point in learning what the true cost of gas was. Eric had mentioned the oil terminal that was proposed to be built in the city of Vancouver. It was stopped by the people of Vancouver. We should never forget that lesson, that people working together can change things. But as we see one victory recede into the past, we see another challenge, an even greater challenge, rise up before us. I shared some of the facts I had learned about the most recent U.S. oil boom with Eric as we continued our conversation. Oil companies won't tell us what they're pumping into the ground because they call it proprietary information. Before Bush became an ex-president, he signed something that removed liability of fracking companies. I've learned that fracking companies they've been losing money the whole time, and their proposition is to make money as they can, pull the cash out, and then go bankrupt. And there are now, and there will be even more, uncapped wells. Have you read any data on that or have any understanding of how the business practices of the fracking industry leaves externalized costs?
Yeah, it's a mess for all the reasons you just mentioned, plus a few more. So so the nature of the operations, unlike some other oil production, oil drilling that we're familiar with, fracking operations are often quite small. You can run a fracking operation, you can start one for, you know, $50 million or something like that, ballpark. I mean, it's still a lot of money, but this is not a big offshore kind of oil well situation. And so you get a lot of small-time operators. The big-time operators are problematic too, but you have a lot of folks who flooded in really fast to the Bakken once fracking technology took off. And it was, you know, sort of a technological revolution, actually, that the oil industry was able to figure out how to drill very deep down, then drill horizontally, and then use explosives to crack open these shale formations and then hold them open with a mix of sand and chemicals. And you're right, it's proprietary. What happens when they do that is that the oil will flood back up to the top, along with a whole bunch of other stuff, including what's called produced water, which often contains radioactive substances and a lot of the chemicals and other stuff. Then they have to do something with all that stuff that comes back out that's not oil or gas. And what they do with it is a big part of the story for why fracking is a problem. Because what they do with it is they, in theory, put it into a tank, a tanker truck, and then take that tanker truck to some safe disposal site. What actually happens to it is that a lot of it gets spilled, wasted, put in a disposal site that's not actually that safe. It infiltrates the water table. There are stories all over the country in the major frack fields of people being poisoned from air and water contamination from the hazardous waste that comes out of those frack sites.
KXRW is run by a small, dedicated group of volunteers. We're supported by members from our community and by our local business partners. I'd like to take a short break to say thank you to two of those partners. When we return, we'll get even deeper into the high price we pay for gas. KXRW would like to thank NuVamsterdam for their ongoing support of community radio. NuVamsterdam is Vancouver's premier cannabis market. Visit NuVamsterdam.com to view and order from their full online menu. And they offer in-store, curbside, and touchless pickup to better serve you. NuVamsterdam is located in the Height Shopping Center on the corner of Mill Plain and Andreessen Road. Open 8 a.m. to 11 p.m., 365 days a year. More information at NuVamsterdam.com. Community radio like this is brought to you by the generous support of our founding sponsors at ADCO, Commercial Printing and Graphics, Clark County's local print shop since 1993. ADCO features stationery, posters, flyers, tickets, business cards, stickers, catalogs, and much more. Print on anything and mail anywhere. Learn more at ADCO1.com. That's ADCO, the number 1.com. In the research I had done to prepare for the interview, I had learned that the economic model for oil companies is to push as much of the cost of their poisonous industry onto people and the planet. But I was shocked to learn how living in some parts of our country is almost like a slow death sentence. What could you tell me about either sacrifice zones around fracking sites or sacrifice zones in and around Louisiana area?
Yeah, and that's a great question. And in a moment, I want to return to the question you raised that I forgot about, which is the finances of the industry, because it's an interesting.
Okay.
But the question about sacrifice zones is exactly the right question to be asking at this time, especially those industrial facilities, oil refineries, petrochemical refineries. There's a huge concentration of them in the Gulf Coast, and it is not an accident that the sacrifice zones are very often, not always, but very often, most commonly next to Black communities or next to Indigenous communities. I mean, it is an expression of the long-term structural problem this country has with racism, that we have located those facilities in those places, some of which have, those communities have been around much longer than the facilities have been, and then we have relaxed the regulations, and then don't enforce the regulations we have. So that literally people are being poisoned. Literally people are being given cancer. Literally their water is being contaminated. And that's been business as usual for decades in this country. And it's a story about race. It's a story about racism as much as it's a story about the environment. And it is important now that we start to see through the lens of race what some of this stuff really means, because it's grotesque. And some of the worst stories, you know, come from the Gulf Coast. They come from Louisiana, parts of Texas. That's all really real. And I take it as sort of my role, because I work for a think tank that's focused on the Northwest, to take a look at, well, what are we doing here in this region that's either better or the same? And in some ways, we're fortunate in this region because we don't have a huge energy industry here. We have 5 refineries on Puget Sound. They produce, they refine almost all of the gasoline and diesel and jet fuel that we used. We don't extract a lot here, thank goodness. But what you do see is those refineries are located either, you know, adjacent to or right on top of, you know, the Swinomish tribe, the Lummi tribe. And so a lot of the impacts from those places are affecting rural indigenous communities that have historically not had a lot of political power. And, you know, is that an accident? I don't think so. And the same story in Canada. Canada has a horrible record of treatment of indigenous communities. The tar sands is, you could go on for an hour about all of the abuses that have happened there, plus the pipeline construction that they're talking about. They want to take this one pipeline, triple it in size, to move to more tar sands oil to the West Coast, moving it right over indigenous lands. It's been fought back against by the native communities there. Much to Justin Trudeau's lasting discredit, he was... has been cheerleading for that pipeline and really, you know, trampling over native rights. And that gets built, it is going to put the San Juan Islands and Puget Sound and the Strait of Juan de Fuca right in the crosshairs. That area is so important for tribes. That's just kind of one glimpse into the way in which sacrifice zones are real, and they are almost always you know, you don't typically sacrifice Portland or Bellevue, Washington or Seattle. You sacrifice Hoquiam or Tacoma or an indigenous community or a black community. And that story just goes on over and over and over again. And I think, frankly, it's very upsetting.
According to the Center for Responsive Politics, oil and gas lobbyists have paid our senators and members of Congress $125 million a year for the last 3 years. It's not a stretch of the imagination to say that the endless stream of cash bribes pouring into Congress is turning our government against us and killing the people who can't afford to get out of the way. It's time to take a short break to thank a very special supporter of KXRW. KXRW wants to thank our friends and sponsors at Boomerang Therapy Works, where exercise is medicine. They offer a variety of one-on-one treatment options that can be tailored to your health and wellness. They provide physical therapy, massage therapy, personal trainers, exercise programs, group classes, and they specialize in customized Parkinson's treatment. Located in downtown Vancouver, find out more at BoomerangTherapyWorks.com. That's BoomerangTherapyWorks.com, where exercise is medicine. Back to our conversation with Eric DePlace. Eric talks about a financial time bomb that has just started to slowly blow up. You mentioned you wanted to come back to finance.
Yeah. And so you raised this really interesting point about finance that is, I think, worth exploring a little bit. So one of the things about the fracking industry that's so interesting is, you know, fracking, it went off like a firecracker right around 2011, 2012. And we had this huge boom in oil and gas production in the U.S., totally unprecedented and unpredicted, actually, by a lot of folks. And there was this belief, well, if they're producing so much, they must be making a lot of money. But in fact, that wasn't true. It was almost like they were on a decade-long Coke binge that was all financed by Wall Street. And so they were taking out huge quantities of debt, rolling it over, going bankrupt over and over again. And what was interesting is mid-2019, you started to hear real grumpiness from Wall Street and the investment community. And by late 2019, you know, people were ready to, you know, say the gig is up. And Wall Street was already starting to pull back on investment in a big way. And it was creating a huge problem. If the coronavirus thing had never happened, 2020 would have seen a wave of bankruptcies in oil and gas fracking. And then coronavirus did happen. And we had a price war going on between Russia and Saudi Arabia. And so what's the end result is just a bloodbath. The industry It was a house of cards before, and now it's a house of cards in a windstorm, and it's really crumbling. And so, like in North Dakota, which is the source of the fracked oil that we use here, the shale oil, I think there's one of the state oil and gas commissioners is saying that 70% of the rigs will be gone from the state by the end of the year. You know, the state's losing like, I don't know, some shocking figure, $300 million a day in lost revenue from the oil industry that it uses to pay for public budgets there. The stock prices, you know, the stock prices are cratered. I mean, they're literally down 70-80% from where they were on January 1st. And so that industry is just cratered right now. It will probably restructure itself at some point, but when it comes back, it will come back smaller, almost certainly. And that's a good thing from my perspective. And so, you know, when I think about the kind of market downturn that's happened during this era of coronavirus, it's almost like it's giving us a little breathing room because the industry is so, it's just a financial mess. And so this is really the opportunity where we can start to say, you know, let's build up more clean energy infrastructure and start to pivot away from this destructive thing we've been doing for a long time. We don't want that industry to come back in the form that it was. So we have a little space right now to do that. And frankly, Wall Street is our best friend in this. They're not going to lend again to that industry because there's not a plausible business case there for many of the industry players.
Well, that I really appreciate you mentioning that Wall Street is our best friend right now. They've been burnt. The taxpayer will be burnt because a great number of those wells will not be tidied up and capped by their funding. They will declare bankruptcy and walk away. And we're going to be stuck with a lot of wells to cap, a lot of environmental cost on that, as well as, you know, fiscal cost. Let's say we want to make America great. How would you do it in terms of energy transition?
Yeah, that's what a good question. So, you know, you're dead on right that as those firms go bankrupt, and even some that don't, they will walk away and abandon all kinds of wells. This happens in the coal industry too, with coal fields. And so there's a tremendous amount that needs to be done to just cap some of those wells. And then going back and fixing the older caps that have degraded, and doing all the kind of restoration that really needs to be done. That is a perfect transitional role for workers in the oil and gas industry or the coal industry who are equipped to do that kind of work, who know how to do it. And I mean, that can be high-paying union jobs that cleans up a big mess. And perhaps this is something that the public invests in. It should come out of the industry's pocket. But if we can't get to them, then I think it's okay, actually, to treat this as a transition that takes 10 or 20 years to restore and rebuild those places, and it will keep people employed in those communities. Because, so we, you know, even though I'm no friend of the industry, we don't want local communities to collapse economically. It's not healthy for anybody, and we've seen what that looks like. If you look at the, you know, the coal producing regions of Appalachia that went down hard, you know, 20 years ago, 10 years ago, we don't want a repeat of that, and we don't want that in North Dakota and Alaska and everywhere else. And it's deeply unfair that those communities got stranded economically. And it's so possible to prevent that from happening with investments in cleanup and restoration, capping those old wells. And then as that work begins to complete, you know, it's continuing to build out the electricity grid, continuing to build out, you know, renewable electricity. There's all kinds of stuff we can do. There's so much stuff we can do that really sets the stage for high-paying jobs, clean energy, and frankly, an economy that just works a lot better than the one we have now, that isn't subject to whiplash, you know, in these commodity prices.
So, if you had a magic wand and you could touch door number one or door number two, door number one is continue through these cycles of boom, bust, economic up and down, or I'm setting you up here. or getting the political will, get Wall Street behind us, get the insurance companies behind us, who are starting to understand that the externalities of climate change are costing billions. Flooding in Miami, Wall Street was flooded out during the storm surge from Hurricane Sandy. Well, let's put it this way. Give me your dream version of the energy transition. You've mentioned jobs, cleaning up and capping wells, taking care of environmental impact in Appalachia. Let's say we do that. What would be your dream proposal for moving forward from that point?
Yeah, I mean, I think it starts with a shared recognition that climate change is real. The longer we delay, the worse it's going to be, and that we start taking action now. And step number one, when you're in a hole, everybody knows this, to stop digging the hole. So that means no new fossil fuel infrastructure, no new pipelines, none of it. It's done. That should be in the past now. Step number two is we start taking out the infrastructure we have, and we do it in an orderly fashion, and we do it with good paying jobs from the industry. We take those workers, transition them into decommissioning infrastructure. We're building out new infrastructure that supports a new clean energy economy. And, you know, and we have set a marker that by, you know, pick a date, 2040, 2050, we're at zero carbon or damn close to it. And then working off, you know, that time frame, 10, 20 years, 30 years, whatever it's going to be, we go after it, and we take out all the old dirty energy infrastructure, replace it with better stuff, and kind of let the magic happen. And I think, you know, on some level, there's a lot of other stuff that we need to do too. We need to take care of the communities that have been harmed. We need to, you know, we need to right a lot of wrongs that have happened, including racial wrongs. But on some level, like at an overarching level, it's actually not terribly complicated. It's completely possible for us to do this, but it does take political will and a shared recognition that if we don't deal with climate change, it is going to bite us in the worst way. And you're right, the insurance industry, you know, they're not idiots. They are waking up to this fact that the costs are going to be out of hand, and Wall Street is coming around to that same realization. So we have some, you know, some unusual and potentially very powerful allies in this movement.
Last question, and I really appreciate your time. COVID it's like World War II now in the United States. We're fighting COVID along with the rest of the world. There are different schools of thought on how important it is to fight it. There are different schools of thought on believing the science or not. What parallels do you see between COVID, either respecting the science or denying the science, and climate change, either respecting the science or denying the science?
Yeah, it's an interesting comparison. And, you know, there's still so much we don't yet know about COVID, but we know a lot. One of the things we know, or that we should know, is that the scientists who study this stuff know more than I do and know more than the average person on the street. And so just as with climate change, we need to be taking what they're saying very, very seriously. It's not that, you know, science is not Moses coming down from the mountain with tablets saying this is the thing, but it is the best thing we have to understand how the world works and what our real threats are. And so it is just distressing to me to see how disregarded science has been in climate, and now how disregarded it's being sometimes in with coronavirus. So we need to figure out how to get science back into the center of the public square and how to have it back into the center of decision making. It's not the only thing. We also have to understand, you know, or to coronavirus, you know, affect people, how they affect businesses and jobs and how they affect inequities and race and all that stuff. It matters too. Like, you have to have other experts, other people at the table. That's what democracy is all about. But, you know, if we can't understand that science is important and we can't use science to guide our decision making, we're in a ton of trouble. And, you know, and maybe you and me aren't as in much trouble as the younger generation. My kid's 11 years old. And if he's grown up in a world where science isn't understood as important, that's not a good world to grow up in. And so we've got to figure out how to change that dynamic, in my opinion.
Thank you. That's well said. That's what I got. Is there anything else you'd like to mention?
No, this is wonderful. You gave me a chance to rant, and I
nice.
I've really enjoyed this conversation. So thank you for making time.
I hope we can have another conversation in the future about something related to this. I really appreciate your time. Is there any reading you would recommend for me or other people to talk to or other websites to go to learn more?
Yeah, I mean, I always point people to Sightline's website because I think it covers a lot of this stuff really well. You know, in the oil and gas world, Columbia Riverkeeper, which is, you know, really near you guys, is a wonderful organization. They do all kinds of amazing work.
Eric DePlace, I really appreciate your time today.
Well, thank you so much, Mike. Have a great day.
You too. Bye-bye. I want to thank Eric DePlace with the Sightline Institute for his passion and dedication in working towards our post-carbon energy future. You can learn more about Sightline at their website at sightline.org. The times we live in have now taught us how to move forward. It is a path paved by scientific fact, social connections, and personal action. My name is Mike Selig, and you've been listening to Voices from Our Community. One day, I hope to hear your voice, too.